Welcome to Financial Insights COP26 podcast series in partnership with Prue UK. All material has been carefully checked for accuracy, but no responsibility can be accepted for inaccuracies. Wherever appropriate, independent research, and wherever necessary, legal advice should be sought before acting on any information contained in this podcast. The value of investments and income from them can go down as well as up. You may not get back the amount you originally invested. The Financial Insight podcast is for investment professionals only. Thank you. Okay, welcome. Today we have Jeremy Lawson on the show. He is Chief Economist and Head of the Aberdeen Research Institute. And we're going to be mostly talking about the Climate Action Tracker's criticism of COP26. Them saying that there is a credibility gap. So up top, we're going to talk about the news of the day. It's Gender, Science and Innovation Day at COP26. Most notably, we have two new programs to boost women's climate leadership and support those most vulnerable to climate change. On the science and innovation front, Alok Sharma had some opening statements earlier in which he said the transition to resilient zero carbon economy is technically possible, is economically attractive and accelerating everywhere. He continued by saying building on existing mechanisms, transparency and accountability must be at the heart of these commitments. And we're going to talk a bit about that later. So the notable announcements and initiatives that we have today would be the Mission Innovation Initiative. This is focused around sort of supply chain issues with low carbon materials for developing nations, essentially to improve climate resilience for them. We also saw the Breakthrough Agenda and the Industrial Deep Carbonisation Initiative, which is emboldening nations to disclose the embodied carbon in major public construction projects at the latest 2025. All of this has happened whilst the Climate Action Tracker have released some staunch criticism saying there's a big credibility gap at COP26. And this is really what we're going to be talking about today. So, apologies for the long introduction, Jeremy. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us today.
My pleasure.
Excellent. So first, let's just introduce you and your role with Aberdeen.
Okay. So Jeremy Lawson, I'm the Chief Economist and Head of the Aberdeen Research Institute. I began working on climate-related issues all the way back in 2006 when I worked as the climate policy advisor to the then leader of the opposition in Australia, Kevin Rudd, in the run-up to the 2007 election. So I was heavily involved in writing the Labor Party's climate policy for that election. And then I also worked at the OECD and I wrote sort of about European climate and energy policy and how it needed to improve to be consistent with their own sort of climate objectives. And now at Aberdeen, I'm responsible primarily for our climate scenario analysis, where we have to sort of take, you know, the information that we're receiving from things like the COP meetings and policy changes in individual countries and sort of sort out the signal from that. And then we can sort of analyse what that means for emissions pathways, the future of energy use, and then ultimately asset prices.
So I've done a long intro talking about the news of the day. Essentially, I've done this so we can cut to the chase and talk about the Climate Action Tracker and their criticisms of COP26. As somebody who models scenarios of these pledges, how credible have these pledges been?
Yeah, so my mantra, our mantra at Aberdeen is pay attention to what governments, corporations, financial institutions are doing, not what they're saying, right? So when you talk about credibility, credibility is ultimately, do these two things align, right? What is your mechanism for connecting what you're pledging to the ultimate outcome? Are the changes embedded in national legislation? Are they binding? Are they of the scale that is necessary to achieve the desired outcome? And if you look at every single one of the headline-grabbing new pledges at COP26, they are wanting on that particular front, right? So you take the take the pledge to end the foreign financing of coal, right? And particularly coal-fired power generation. Well, the number of signatories to that pledge does not cover all the countries in the world. It actually doesn't cover private sector financing of that. And then it also doesn't cover or prevent individual countries from continuing to invest within their own sort of borders in coal-fired power stations or coal mining, right? And then even beyond that, even for those mechanisms that have been agreed, right, you sort of have to take them on faith. There isn't anything that sort of that binds the signatories, those that have agreed to that, to pursue it. So then you've got sort of four criteria there where there is this enormous sort of gap between what you're seeing in your headlines, right, and what's actually likely to transpire. And there are similar problems when it comes to the pledges on reducing methane emissions, when it comes to deforestation, and then just the aggregate emissions reduction pledges. So as you can tell, I'm Australian, right, from my accent. So Australia, for the first time, brought a net zero 2050 pledge to these talks. So you might look at it and they go, great, Australia is finally properly within the fold. But there was not a single new policy announcement associated with that 2050 pledge. Australia didn't change its 2030 target, right? And so there's no mechanism that connects the 2050 pledge, right, to a pathway that is consistent with the amount of emissions reductions that are necessary to achieve it. And so it sort of brings us then back to the Climate Action Tracker. In the simplest terms, what they're pointing out is this sort of this gap. Is it to be on, say, a net zero 2050 pathway where the ultimate objective is to limit warming, heating to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, then we don't have 10 years to wait. You can't defer this problem out to 2040 or 2035. You need to make very, very significant global reductions beginning now. And actually, that is not what's occurring. A lot of the new pledges push it out beyond 2030. And as I say, many of these new pledges have almost sort of nothing sort of concrete to back them up.
So part of today's agenda is innovation. Yeah. And innovation is a great thing. For me, having heard what you just said about pledges, it seems like innovation is a hard thing to quantify. And maybe you could comment on this.
Yeah, so I think one way to think about it is, what is capitalism, right? Capitalism is effectively an engine for innovation. We achieve economic growth, productivity growth, by finding new and better ways to do things, right? Create new products, make existing products sort of more cheaply, whatever it happens to be. So the climate challenge actually in many ways is an innovation challenge, right? It is about, so let's take electrical vehicles or solar PV use in the power sector, right? So you have these sort of big technological problems that need to be overcome. In electrical vehicles, it is how do we reduce the cost of batteries and reduce their size, whilst also allowing those sort of vehicles to be able to run over much longer periods, so that people don't have to recharge once they've driven sort of short distances, right? So all of that is ultimately an innovation challenge. Or you take sort of, you know, solar panels. The big challenge here is we need to solve the intermittency problem. That is, we need to be able to draw on renewable energy when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. We can only do that if you can find a way to store it cheaply and then transmit it over long distances. All of this requires innovation. Innovation is taking place, like in the solar space. Say Bloomberg sort of estimates are that in some categories, electrical vehicles, though they will become cost competitive with traditional sort of diesel and petrol cars within sort of 5 years. Well, that's innovation that is bringing about that change. The relative cost of solar power has been declining every year quite rapidly for 10 years. The problem we have, though, right, so there is innovation taking place, is it's not happening fast enough to be aligned with the net zero goal. And why is that? Well, part of it is that actually the government pledges to finance, subsidise R&D, they're not on a large enough sort of scale to make those breakthroughs more quickly. Maybe more importantly is we still don't adequately price carbon, right? So many of the listeners to this are probably familiar with the principle of carbon taxes, emissions trading schemes. What they're really about is sort of saying, if you find a way to mean that the social and environmental cost of polluters' actions, right, is what they face, right, then that can act as a very, very powerful signal, right, for change, for innovation. Because if I'm going to face a tax on my polluting activities, I'm going to find ways to minimize that taxation, and innovation is one of the ways that we do so. So our big problem is you can't catalyze the amount of innovation that we need to if you don't force polluters to internalize the costs of their pollution.
Let's now talk about some of the changes that have happened, and especially in renewable energy penetration, and some of the things, some of this innovation that has taken place so far.
So there have been, just again, within the last 10 years, we've seen some very significant changes in the energy system, right? So even though governments aren't, say, penalizing coal emissions as much as they should be, the usage of coal, particularly in the developed countries, has been declining very significantly, and it's being sort of replaced in some parts by the use of natural gas, which is cleaner than coal. It's not clean, but it's cleaner than coal. And then also renewable energy. In the United Kingdom, where we are, there have been a number of individual days this year where all electricity usage was effectively supplied from renewable inputs rather than any fossil fuel inputs. And if you'd asked somebody sort of 10 years ago, you know, whether that was likely, they would have said actually that would be extremely, extremely difficult to achieve. So every year, what we're seeing is that the renewable energy share of electricity generation or heating, electrical vehicle penetration, it's increasing. There's more than that. It's generally increasing at a faster pace than had originally been expected. So this is another way of just sort of saying there is a really enormous energy transition sort of taking place. So for example, in our scenario work, in our analysis, even though we don't think that these pledges are going to translate into keeping temperatures below 2 degrees, you know, by the end of the century, we're still expecting by 2050 the majority of passenger vehicles on the road to be electrical vehicles. We're still expecting the majority of power sector energy usage to be renewable by the middle of the century, right? So there is a lot of change taking place. But it's just not fast enough to be on a net zero trajectory, if that makes sense.
So, yeah, should we do closing comments and maybe talk a bit about what you guys are working on at Aberdeen?
Okay. So look, Aberdeen is a firm that takes our responsibility in this space very seriously, right? So there is no solution to the climate problem unless all actors are involved, government, non-financial corporations, the financial sector, right? So we've all got a role to play. So for example, during COP, we pledged to reduce the carbon intensity of our investments by 50% relative to a 2019 benchmark by 2030, right? So that's a very significant sort of pace of annual reduction. We engage in an enormous amount of climate sort of research. So I talked about climate scenarios beforehand. I don't want to bore the listeners with it. But what we're trying to do is generate new insights about the future of energy. What does that mean for asset prices? And so then how can people invest to take advantage of it? So instead of thinking about climate change as all about risk, we can also think about climate change as one of opportunity for investors, right? You know, because that's what economic transformations do. They throw up opportunities. You know, the other thing that we do is a lot of work around engagement with the companies that we invest in, or in government, right? So using our power of influence as large investors. And then finally, we build solutions for asset owners, for clients, right? So people who sort of say, well, actually, this is what I want my money to be doing, right? I don't want my money to be financing that type of activity. I want it to be on a net zero pathway. How can you design something that still allows me to meet my financial goals, but also allows me to do good for the planet? And so we've got a very active program in each of those areas. So I think what you can sort of see is, you know, within the financial industry, a climate strategy has many pillars to it, and they all have to be pointed in the right direction. Now, that doesn't mean that everything we're doing is fully integrated with a 1.5 degree pathway, because unfortunately, financial sector, you know, decisions, they also need that government action to get right on that pyro. So everything needs to come together. But we feel like we're doing some very substantial things in this sort of place to, you know, to play our part.
Jeremy, thank you so much for this conversation today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you would like to hear more from the IFA Magazine's COP26 podcast series, please check out ifamagazine.com, where we have a dedicated section just to this podcast. Elsewhere, you can check us out on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or of course, Podbean. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.